The roots of Bletchley Park's code-breaking success in World War II can be clearly traced back to World War I, when several of the key figures of the Government Code and Cipher School were already engaged in the business of snooping into the enemy's communications. A major new exhibition tracing the roots of this code-breaking powerhouse back 100 years is now open and will be formally launched soon. The first people to see it were members of the Friends of Bletchley Park. Podcast producer Mark Cotton and I went along to see what they made of it.
Good evening. For those I've not met, I'm Ian Standard. I'm chief executive here at Bletchley Park, and it's my privilege and pleasure to welcome you here this evening to the Friends preview of our new exhibition, The Road to Bletchley Park. This exhibition has been 2 years in the making. All these things seem very simple, but actually take a lot of time and effort to take them from a concept to the exhibition you're going to see this evening. This has been a road of fundraising, research, development, getting together all the bits and pieces, and finally the installation, which actually is the easy bit compared to all the others. So it's a 2 year journey to get to where we are now. And this exhibition is a very important exhibition for us. It tells the story of really the birth of modern communications technology, or more importantly, how you exploit that to produce intelligence. So it talks about cable, wireless, and the people who started the First World War in breaking into these communications means and producing war-winning intelligence. And very importantly, it talks about the people who were doing it. Because, as you'll see and hear, many of the people involved in the First World War went on to ply their trade here at Bletchley Park during the Second World War. So it is an important backstory to what we do here and sets the scene, hence the reason why it's called The Road to Bletchley Park. Of course, it's very important that it is open at this time as well, because we are, of course, in the centenary of the First World War. So it's only fitting that we do our own tribute to the First World War here at this time. And as we are running a commercial heritage attraction, hopefully that will encourage more people who perhaps have an interest in the First World War rather than the Second World War to come here and then explore the park further to find out more about the fantastic work that went on here during the Second World War. As a World War I buff myself and a battlefield guide, I'm also very excited about this exhibition because it's telling a story that nobody else seems to be telling at the moment. You can go to the Imperial War Museum in London and look at their fantastic new World War I gallery. And the bit about this particular aspect of the First World War is one panel. So it's great. We're taking that and expanding it out into a whole spur here, telling that story. So I think we're telling a unique exhibition. I should also point out that what you're seeing today is only part one. This is a two-part exhibition. The first part runs for 2 years, and then in 2017, we open up the second part. So do please come back when we have the second launch in a couple of years' time to see the second half of this exhibition. Now, of course, all these things don't happen without many people in the background. And I'm going to run through, and excuse me if I read off my list to make sure I don't miss anybody, some of the thanks that we owe for this exhibition coming into fruition. First of all, very importantly, the funders, BAE and Ultra Electronics, two firms with long lineages in the electronics industry, and both of whom can trace back their ancestry to people involved in this story in the First World War. So it's great for them to be able to sponsor this exhibition and create that link between what they do today and the First World War. And talking about funders, Claire Graysbrook, who drove the fundraising team and drove the process to bring that money in, which is very important. Event Communication, who work with us, they've worked with us on a number of other projects to deliver the exhibition and have taken these concepts and ideas and research and turned them into a very engaging and interesting exhibition. GCHQ, again, many of you will know that a relationship we have with GCHQ. In large part, we are there outside the Wire Museum, and they keep on turning up great little things for us to show in exhibitions. You'll find some of the artifacts in there have come from GCHQ. Our in-house team, the curatorial staff who've worked right up to the wire today to make sure everything's in place, everything's working, and everything's on show. Dr. Sarah Ralph. Sarah has been involved with this programme intimately for the last year, doing all the research, putting together all the material to allow us to produce the exhibition that we have here.
Approaching the entrance to the World War I exhibition, which is called The Road to Bletchley Park, because that's what it takes you on, the road from code-breaking World War I to where we are here at Bletchley Park.
focused on those 6 years of World War II. And with Sarah Ruff, our World War I research coordinator, who's the brain behind this exhibition, really.
We got to preview the exhibition to the Friends, and it was really good to see people react to this story, because as we've been trying to explain throughout this exhibition, is that it's a story that isn't that well known. And obviously with World War I, you think obviously of sort of the horrific loss of life on the trenches, but there's also this secret war that was taking place back in London with the development of code breaking. And so quite a few of the personalities that started off in World War I then came to Bletchley Park in World War II. So it's really nice to see people learn about this sort of new story to do with code breaking, and obviously then the links to Bletchley Park.
So it's about the foundations that were laid in the way that code breaking was tackled and some of the personalities involved. And of course it's something that was inevitably personality driven, wasn't it?
That's been the great thing about sort of doing the research for this, is you get to learn about the people who started it, and obviously testing out ideas really to do with code breaking and learning new skills and new knowledge, because really this is sort of the first time on a large scale that code breaking is taking place and being used to gather signals intelligence. So there are some really key people that come from the universities, from naval education, that obviously make a big impact on the code breaking. And so it's been really nice to sort of read about their stories, and obviously we have some really nice photographs too of those individuals.
Well, it can seem quite a dry way of finding out about people to someone who's not a professional researcher like yourself. You know, photographs that are 100 years old and documents and records, but you've found life jumping off those pieces of paper, haven't you?
Well, it's sort of the way in which things get described, and particularly with a document that we found at the University of Aberdeen in the collections there associated with Malcolm Hay, who was the head of MI1B, who was the Army code-breaking section. This was a book that was given to Malcolm Hay on his retirement after the First World War. And it gave you sort of these really nice personal insights, the way it had been written, and obviously the affection that they had for Malcolm Hay and also the work that they were doing. So this sort of allowed you to sort of learn a little bit more about their lives and how they experienced war within the offices, particularly, as I said, of MI1B.
So let's go inside. So we start off with an archway. Tell me about that.
Obviously, working with Event, who are the design team, we were really keen to sort of emphasise the fact that this isn't something that was happening at Bletchley Park. So we have the Admiralty arches being created here, so you immediately get the impression that you're definitely not in Bletchley Park. So we move in, and hopefully you can see on either side of this sort of lenticular effect of walking through Admiralty arches, and then you have the image of London.
So to describe a lenticular, as this isn't a visual medium podcasting, you've got a zigzag shaped kind of vertical panel system, so there's about half a dozen vertical panels, and you're looking at them in one direction as you walk in. You see them sort of lined up one behind the other, and those images connect, so they're sort of sections of an image.
Yes.
So on the way in you see one set of images, and on the way out you see Bletchley Park.
Yes.
The AV is quite important in this exhibition, isn't it? Tell me about the introductory video.
This is obviously setting out in a sort of a very brief and visual way the work that was actually carried out during World War One, and how the two sections of code breaking in the Admiralty and with the Army were established, and also giving you a brief overview of the type of work that they were doing. The images that are being used, I think, sort of really highlight the work that they were doing. And so some of these come from the archives as well. So, we're really pleased with how this has turned out.
I think there's a real richness to these images. I really think it jumps off the screen in a way that perhaps you don't expect of photos so old, which are very, very two-dimensional. They're black and white. They're quite contained in a way, images like that, aren't they? But this gives them somehow, it's something very clever with the perspective they've done that gives them the depth and life.
Well, the idea behind this section also was to create sort of a theatrical effect. So you have this image being created around the screen that sort of looks a bit like a cinematographic
image. Oh, yes,
image.
The curtains, yeah. And yeah.
This is obviously where we're trying to introduce the story of World War One code breaking, but also introduce in this section the technologies that were so key to the code breakers.
And we have a replica of a Marconi crystal receiver set. How important was this equipment?
We really wanted to emphasise the type of technology that was sort of at the hands.
It's less easy to do for this period, isn't it, than it is for World War II, because obviously we have access to all GCHQ's existing surviving equipment. That's not the case with this, is it?
There are sort of few examples that still survive. So we've had a replica made of a Marconi crystal receiver set, but what we really wanted to show is that We often think about wireless and cable as being sort of relatively old technologies, but obviously at the time of World War One, these were actually relatively new. And so these were cutting edge. And so we really wanted to show this through the equipment that was being used, and then also show this through the graphics and the information about how the codebreakers were able to utilise this technology and draw on all this new scientific development to help them intercept coded messages, but then also use direction finding equipment to be able to sort of track the movement of German airships, U-boats, and obviously naval vessels as well. And all of this was obviously important to sort of halt any attacks that would happen on the British mainland, but also gain information to use for their advantage.
It's something we often say at Bletchley Park, that how much war is a driver of new technology, and you know, it really accelerates it, doesn't it? And that's obviously the case in that conflict as well. Let's walk through to the next section.
Hello, welcome to MO5E. The room is not very big, and there are still two or three more to fit in. Where were you before being recruited to this department?
I was up at Cambridge doing European languages, enjoying rowing, rugby, beer, and playing mahjong.
Here, let's hope you enjoy deciphering intercepted German wireless messages just as much. But first things first, we must get you a cup of tea.
Obviously, this is a two-part exhibition as well. So this first phase that we have that runs till 2017 is all about introducing the two organisations that developed at the start of the First World War. So we have MI1B, which is the Army Codebreaking Unit, and we also then have the Naval Codebreaking Unit, which is Room 40. So this particular area where we're standing in at the minute introduces MI1B, the Army Codebreakers. In this one, we have a lot of photographs that have come to us from the collections of Malcolm Hay up at the University of Aberdeen. And these give you a really nice insight into the physical codebreakers themselves. You get to actually see what they look like, where they actually worked, and sort of the type of things that they were working on. So this has been really interesting for me to be able to sort of see the people that you're reading about jump off of a photograph. We have selected pages as well that come from this retirement book. There's a lovely colour depiction of how they viewed themselves in terms of sort of ancient Egypt. And so this was drawn by one of the workers, and there was a story written about the work of MI1B based on sort of ancient Egypt.
It just shows what kind of highly educated people these were, that their minds were not only Lewis Carroll, but cartoons in the context of ancient Egypt, and writing in code to each other, and poems at great length and with great skill.
I know, and obviously, as I said, for the array of languages that have been written in the book as well, it just shows you the sort of the diverse nature of the people that were coming together.
I'm starting to see why you got so excited about this book now, because there's so much rich material in it for you to learn.
This is to sort of give you an overview of some of the documents that were created as a result of the work of the codebreakers themselves. This is an opportunity to see the codebreaking books that were used by the World War One units, particularly Room 40, as they have a larger archive that remained after World War One compared to MI1B. So here we've got a copy of a codebook called the AFB codebook that was Birch's personal copy. And as you go through the code book, there's details that relate to the different types of U-boats in particular, and Birch is written next to each of those call signs when they were sunk, what happened to them. So again, you've got this really nice personal sort of way of looking at the war in relation to particular vessels that we have here.
Very unusual message. It doesn't seem to follow the standard patterns of naval terminology. Codes can be so damn tricky to break without a crib. A practice code, sent by the operator, perhaps. A poem?
So now we come to Room 40. Where Dilly Knox must have been working, because here we have a bath.
Yes.
Now, not a lot of people know that. That's perhaps not as common knowledge as we think it is.
As we're going through the research, we sort of came across little descriptions of how Dilly Knox chose the office in the Admiralty that had the only bath, because he often did his best work in the bath. So here we have a bath to sort of replicate that within Room 40. And there's also an audio that plays that is based off of an anecdote of him solving a particular code based on recognising that it links into a German poem.
A eureka moment, but with more methodical kind of brain work put into it leading up to his realisation. Yeah, that's brilliant. And tell me about the tubes.
And again, there's a sort of an element of discovery within the exhibition too.
These were pneumatic tubes.
Tubes, yeah. And here we've got some illustrations relating to Room 40 and a concert that they did at the end of the war that sort of celebrated the work that they'd completed, but all in the guise of Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, which is a theme that you'll see in sort of Room 40, based off of this concert that they did at the end of the war. Birch wrote a parody, really, of the work that Room 40 did, and there are a number of caricatures that were drawn into this that sort of highlight particular characters that were working in Room 40 and how they were linked into characters from Alice's Adventures in Wonderland. It's been nice to sort of research this aspect of World War One, which is relatively unknown, and to sort of bring it to the public so they get to actually realise there was this secret war that was taking place, which perhaps code-breaking is always now associated with World War Two, but actually it had its roots really in World War One.
I'm very impressed by the various bits and pieces that I've seen here. I know the basic plot, but seeing some of the actual evidence in photographs and copies of handwritten instructions is quite different from reading it at second hand, if you like, in history books.
It brings it all together, doesn't it? And brings it to life somewhat. It
certainly adds at least half a dimension to what I know already, so it's good news, good value.
It's good to know that someone who knows the story already finds it well told here. That's
encouraging. It works.
Excellent.
It also gives me some information that helps understand other things not related to the subject. So, for example, the cable network that the British maintained had a rather interesting use from the Dutch East Indies, from Java, during the great sugar beet boom just after the First World War, when a character who was rather too near the edge of the law to be sure which side of it he was on made a lot of money through early information about sugar beet prices and sugar movements by cable to European markets, not by putting them on the cable which is direct, which was full of other things, but sending the messages first to Australia and then to South Africa and round the bottom end of Africa to Europe, and therefore getting ahead of his competition. They make it much more clear, that picture of the cable network.
There's always more to learn, isn't there, about any subject?
One of the nice things about this is that you never know when something unexpected turns up that teaches you something that fills a gap.
Yeah.
And this fills a gap not just in the First World War, but other things.
Well, I'm glad you've enjoyed it.
It's worth the trip.
Thank you.
One of Britain's first actions of the war was a master stroke of communication sabotage. On the night of the 4th of August 1914, five of Germany's six cables in the English Channel were cut. The sixth cable was redirected to be used by the British to intercept German communications. Britain had already recognised the importance of cable. It encircled the world with lines and ran them only across its own red territories and under the ocean. The all-red line was considered complete by 1911. Not only were UK cables protected from interference, many foreign powers were forced to use Britain's extensive network for their own messaging. Britain was in the ideal position to intercept friends and foes alike.
Yes, very good, isn't it?
It's very good, yeah.
We've been here a few times, haven't we? Had a few visits. Very interesting. Yeah.
I love the entrance.
Yes,
the
very
clever. It's quite evocative. It is very Whitehall. I like that. And as we go out, look, it's the road to Bletchley Park. So there's Bletchley Station. I think that's really clever.
Yeah. No, I mean, I must admit, I thought it was going to be a little bit dry, to be honest, you know, but it's not.
No, it's not.
It's
really
about
good.
The people, isn't it?
That's great.
It is, yeah.
We did a very quick walk round, and now we're going to do a slower walk round and actually read more stuff.
That's right.
To just get an over impression of what was here.
That's it.
Make sure you listen out for Dilly and Bob.
Okay.
Okay, right.
Thank you.
Okay.
Mr. Knox, I know that you're in the bath, but do you need me to take down any codes that you've deciphered during the night?
Miss Rodham, I must speak with Dr. Willoughby at once.
I think it was an excellent exhibition. The introductory film was brilliant. I thought the effects on that was superb. I really love the period feel to the exhibition. The documentation that's been shown is wonderful. As well as being a Bletchley Parker file, my interest has expanded into the American code breaking and the World War One code breaking as well. From what I know of the story, it's very accurate, and like I say, the introductory film, I think, hit the nail on the head. It's not overlong, so people aren't going to get bored and walk away. It tells the critical points during the war, the cable cutting, the Zimmerman telegram, and the visuals that accompany the story are stunning. I'm really amazed with it. And the rest of the exhibition as well. And I like the bathtub. It's a nice touch, because that's a story that's been told in many of the Bletchley books as well.
By the time the war ended, MI1B employed just under 90 people. Britain had become a world leader in the field of intelligence. In 1919, Alistair Denniston, a Room 40 linguist and codebreaker, headed a carefully selected group of Room 40 and MI1B employees, forming the new Government Code and Cipher School, which continued to ply its trade through the 1920s and 30s, before Denniston brought his team here to Bletchley Park at the advent of the Second World War.
It's nice for the first time to actually see the story of the First World War code-breaking told, so that we can discover the history prior to the Government Code and Cipher School and see the separate roles played by the Army Intelligence and also the Naval Intelligence, and how they came together to form the Government Code and Cipher School and what happened at Bletchley Park during the Second World War. Stuff like Dilly's Bath. But it's the personal history, isn't it? It's the personal way that they used to work and the techniques that they use. You hear these names, but you know that they started a bit earlier than that. They were here in the First World War. Got all different archives in here. You know, like Ian said, you can bring them all together, can't you? Which is really good.
I sat with Ian Standen, CEO of Bletchley Park, after yet another new exhibition opening. Bletchley Park is just growing from strength to strength, isn't it?
Indeed, and this particular exhibition is great to be able to launch it during the centenary of the First World War. It's an exhibition about code-breaking and intelligence production in the First World War, and provides us with an insight into how, I suppose, the SIGINT business really started. You know, the First World War sees the advent of radio and cable for military communications and indeed diplomatic communications, and then very quickly people breaking into those means of communication to provide intelligence.
World War One, in reality, was the first, some people describe it as modern war, because the First World War was the first war really to have such massive advances in technology, wasn't it? In the air, on the land, you know, simple things like the machine gun. But we see that in our side of the story as well, don't we?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, the First World War brought together, so I suppose, the elements of modern warfare that started with the American Civil War and through the sort of back end of the 19th century. But the First World War probably saw the greatest technological advances, and you say, in the business that we look at Bletchley Park, in the SIGINT business, huge technological leaps during that war. And as a result, you know, this production of, you know, valuable intelligence from cable and radio, but also, very importantly, it gave a lot of people a grounding in the business and understanding, which helped in the title of the exhibition. It's called The Road to Bletchley Park, helped with the folks doing their work in the Second World War. As you'll see through the exhibition, a number of characters started plying their trade in the First World War. That's Dean Ox, Frank Birch, Alistair Denniston, to name, you know, but three, who all appear on the roster of Bletchley Park during the Second World War. And that's a very important strand that we pick up in the exhibition, that people strand, and try to understand not only, you know, their initial exposure to the business and development of it in the First World War, but also some of the humorous sides. You've seen the Alice and ID 25, this comedy book pantomime that was produced by the folks in Room 40 at the end of the war to just sort of, if you like, laugh at themselves at the end of the war, using the Alice in Wonderland story as a vehicle to sort of take the mick out of each other. On the other side, in the MI1B story again, you'll see this replica of Major Hayes, leaving President Major Hayes was the guy in charge of MI1B, and his team affectionately put together this book, which again was a series of anecdotes and cartoons and what have you of the folks. So you really get under the skin of the individuals here, get that individual story.
And Dilly's bath
indeed. Yeah, I won't spoil the fun, but yes, there's a bath that appears in the exhibition that picks a Dilly Knox story, and for those people who know Dilly Knox will probably know what we're talking about. For those who come and see, you know, Dilly's bath and understand the story around it.
So turning really personally for you, because you've had a fascination in World War One especially, haven't you, for years?
Indeed. I mean, my personal interest in history is really the industrialisation of warfare, so from the American Civil War through to the end of the First World War, really. So it was great to be able to sort of help steer this exhibition out, you know, having been on the battlefields of the First World War, taken people around for many years. It's nice to look at another one of the different stories. Mm. You know, this is a story that as I said at the sort of the opening with the friends this evening, it's a story that nobody else is really telling. There's a very small part about Zimmermann Telegram, I think, in the Imperial War Museum's great new First World War galleries.
Which was so important.
Absolutely, but we're telling a piece that nobody else seems to be telling, which is great. So it provides those people with an interest in the First World War, some are different to come on those World War One trail around the countryside and come and see a different story. And it's perhaps worth putting at this point, of course, you know, like all these exhibitions, they don't come cheap and they have to be funded, and it's worth recognising that the funders of this exhibition also have a lineage in this business. Ultra Electronics and BAE both trace themselves back to companies who were involved in this business in the First World War, so it's great for them that they can support us, without which it wouldn't happen, but also, you know, connect their modern existence with their
predecessors. It's that great link back to Marconi, isn't
absolutely
it?
Yeah, the Marconi thing is at the heart of the World War One radio story.